we get things underway this afternoon by getting on board the telephone line and welcoming back to the program NASA historian Bill Berry. Bill, thanks for being with us.
Rich, my pleasure.
You've got a main connection, which makes it even better for us this afternoon.
Oh, yeah. That Maine's one of my favorite places. We were stationed up at Loring Air Force Base, my first Air Force assignment, flying the KC-135 up there. And then the Air Force, in its infinite wisdom, moved me down to Pease Air Force Base in New Hampshire for my next assignment. And we actually lived in South Berwick. So I've lived on both ends of the state of Maine.
Excellent. Well, you know it very well. Well, we're looking forward to a big, big anniversary of 50 years this July 20th of Apollo 11 and the moon landing. First of all, what's going on officially for NASA to commemorate this event?
Well, we've got a whole series of events that are going on, both at the various NASA centers around the country, but sort of the focal point for the major celebration will be a three-day event on the National Mall that we're doing in collaboration with the National Air and Space Museum. So that will be a big display event that will be both inside the museum and outside the museum, and the Smithsonian's got some surprises up their sleeve for some fun programming they're going to do in the evenings there. So that'll be great. NASA itself is doing a coast-to-coast TV broadcast on the afternoon of July 19th, so from 1 to 2:30 on July 19th. We'll have a 90-minute broadcast that will have remote locations at the National Mall from that celebration there with astronaut Mike Collins from the Apollo 11 crew, but also we'll be going remote to the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama, where they built the Saturn V rocket that got us to the moon, and of course Johnson Space Center in Houston, and Wapakoneta, Ohio, Neil Armstrong's hometown, and possibly some other locations as well that we're negotiating with. So there are those run-up events, and then of course the anniversary itself falls on Saturday, July 20th, and we'll be rebroadcasting, 50 years in real time plus 50 years the landing and the first moonwalk, both on our social media and web channels and on NASA TV, and also we'll be collaborating with the Kennedy Center here in Washington, D.C. for a major concert that Saturday night. So lots of things happening to mark this golden anniversary of the first moon landing.
That's wonderful, and it highlights the scope of the operation, that this was not just obviously the three men in the spacecraft or the people in Florida, but crews all over the United States, engineers, scientists, mathematicians, people really all over the world when you take into account the people who were tracking the flight as well.
Yeah, there by our count, there are about 400,000 people, just over 400,000 people involved in the mission worldwide, and that did include folks at the tracking stations around the planet, and also some scientists around. There were scientists who were involved in the decision about what kind of samples to collect and the analysis of those samples after they came back. So literally hundreds of scientists around the world were sent samples of the moon rocks after they came out of quarantine to do analysis. And about 6 months later in January 1970, they had a big conference to compare all their results, which is pretty interesting. But even in the United States, there were 20,000 U.S. companies. I mean, of course, the big giants like Boeing and Rockwell and North American and Douglas and everybody else were involved in the program building these. But there were literally 20,000 U.S. companies involved in the Apollo program. I should have checked, but I'm sure there were at least a few of those companies located in the great state of Maine. I know there were several in Massachusetts where I grew up. So it was a widespread effort. Everybody knew somebody. Jack Leary, the guy who lived across the street from my family when I was growing up, Mr. Leary was a local hero because he worked for a company that made little tiny precision gears. It's a small company that had 60 employees, and they made small precision gears, some of which wound up in the Saturn V booster. So he was my hero when I was a kid.
Well, and the focus is on Apollo 11, but it's interesting to look back and realize what an incredibly challenging and ambitious schedule NASA had in the 6 months prior to the moon landing, with three trips, Apollo 8, 9, and 10, all laying the groundwork for the flight of Apollo 11.
Yeah, you're exactly right there. It was not only a very ambitious schedule, but NASA was very lucky. And those missions all went very well. We actually, for planning purposes, folks at NASA had assumed that at least one of those missions would probably need to be either repeated or there'd be some parts of that they'd have to redo on some of the mission. But things went remarkably well in all of those missions, and from late 1968 into early 1969. We announced a crew of Apollo 11 in January 1969, the plan was that they would be the first that might have a chance to land on the moon. But as the spring of 1969 went along, with Apollo 9 going well and then Apollo 10, it became clear that in fact they were going to be the first crew to attempt the landing, and it became clear. But it could well have been Pete Conrad as the first man on the moon if there'd been a problem in that assignment had slipped to Apollo 12.
I think it was Tom Wolfe who coined the phrase "the right stuff." And when you look at the longevity that so many astronauts have had, not only three men living today who've walked on the moon, but so many of those crews from not just Apollo, but the Mercury flights, so many of those guys lived to be into their 80s and 90s. So clearly they did have some of the right stuff.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes if that's a sort of magic. But actually, I think part of it was the selection process, particularly the Mercury 7, and a little bit less so for the other ones, but they had every possible biological system tested. So they were in extraordinarily good health when they were selected as astronauts. And that probably helps with the longevity question. But there are guys who got good medical care. Most of them were military veterans, and they also NASA. We couldn't require them after they retired to come back to Houston for an annual physical, but NASA gave every one of those guys an annual physical for free every year, because we wanted the data on how their space experience impacted their health, and for most of them, it did well. So they not only had the advantage of walking into the program with generally good health to start with, but they were closely monitored after that. And I think that probably contributed to their longevity. But yeah, you're right. There are only a handful of folks left who were flown those Apollo missions, and sadly, many of them were passed from the scene just in the last couple of years.
We're talking with NASA historian Bill Berry here on Downtown. I was only 11 years old, but I was a huge fan. My mother let me stay up and woke me up to watch Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walk on the moon. Of all the things, my recollection as a little kid, of all the things that were scariest from a layman's perspective at the time, because it had never been done before, it was the takeoff of the lunar module from the lunar surface. Was that also, from the perspective of the people involved, the most challenging part of the operation?
Rich, you and I are the same age, actually. I was 11 when we landed on the moon as well. I remember it well, too. Actually, I managed to argue long enough with my parents that by the time they were finally getting ready to send me to bed, that they changed the schedule. Because originally the crew landed and they were supposed to sleep. I don't know how they expected that to happen, but that was the schedule. So my mom and dad argued, go to bed, we'll wake you up at 2 in the morning when we're walking the moon. I argued with them for a long time. They finally, by the time they were sent me off down the hall, Walter Cronkite comes on and says, "Oh, they're going to move up the landing or the moonwalk," and so I get to stay up. There were a lot of things that were sensitive operations that we hadn't done. The launch from the surface was particularly critical because it relied on one rocket engine, and if that engine didn't work, those guys were going to be stuck on the moon. And there actually was a close call on that one. The switch that they needed, one of the switches they needed to flip to enable that engine to fire, broke. And the switch part of it broke off. And Buzz Aldrin very very cleverly, you know, pulled a felt tip pen out of his pocket and stuffed it into the hole where the switch was, and was able to move the switch with that. So they successfully got off the surface of the moon. If you were to ask Neil Armstrong about it, I think he would have told you that the landing was probably the thing he was most concerned about.
Well, because then he had to do some of that manually, right?
Yeah. They get that. There are a number of things that if you don't know the lingo and you don't know what's going on, and it kind of sounds like, you know, they're just, you know, landing on the moon, no big deal. But they had some computer alarms that went off that they weren't expecting, and those kind of raised the pucker factor. But the big problem was that we didn't understand the gravity field of the moon quite as well as we would have liked at the time. And so the Eagle lunar module was landing along. It kind of missed the landing point and was going to land further down its path than had been planned. And where it was going to land actually wanted to be a big field full of boulders. And Neil didn't want to land on a big field full of boulders. So as he's coming down, he sees that that's where they're heading. And he basically levels off at, you know, a couple hundred feet above the surface and steps on the gas pedal to go sideways, you know, literally hovering over the moon and going sideways to find a clear spot to land on. And meanwhile, the fuel is ticking down, and they landed with seconds of fuel remaining. And that was probably the thing that was most the most critical thing, I think, if you were to look at it. But again, you know, these guys are test pilots. They didn't, you know, if you're listening to the audio, you really don't get, you know, that anybody was nervous about it. It just sort of seems like, oh, well, okay, these, you know. But when they're calling 30 seconds of fuel remaining, it was people in Houston were really nervous.
As we look back and celebrate this 50th anniversary this summer, I know that NASA is always subject to the whims of politicians as well, but what is the future of manned spaceflight?
President Trump has said that we're going back to the moon and then on to Mars. The decision that we'd go back, that NASA would formally go on to Mars, has really been announced by the president, President Bush, actually, back in 2003, and the Congress approved that. So that's been our plan, is that we would eventually get there. When are we going to do that is sort of the big question, and that's driven by how much of a budget NASA has. And typically we've been running at sort of the same budget level. Back in the Apollo days, when we had to build NASA, I mean, we had to build entire centers, and we had to, you know, help colleges and universities build faculties to get us the kind of people we needed to, because, you know, there weren't any planetary geologists around in the 1950s, so we helped. And a lot of the $25 billion that the U.S. spent on Apollo was spent not just on rockets and stuff, but a lot of it was building infrastructure. And so we've got that. We now get that infrastructure, so we probably don't need as much now. But back in those days, you know, at the peak, NASA was getting about 5% of the federal budget, and the public, generally speaking, didn't, you know, thought that was too much. So that was likely to get cut back anyway. These days, NASA gets about less than one half of 1% of the federal budget. So, you know, we produce a lot of great science and inspiration on a pretty limited budget these days. Sending humans out to other planets is going to take a little more money. And just yesterday, the president sent a budget amendment over to Capitol Hill for the next year's fiscal year budget for the spending year that starts October 1st this year. They added $1.6 billion to their request of the Congress to accelerate our plans to land humans back on the moon by 2024. So that's the plan. We're going to land the first people back on the moon on the south pole of the moon, near Shackleton Crater on the south pole of the moon in 2024. And assuming the Congress approves that spending plan, looks like we'll be on track to be able to meet that objective.
Well, I hope this 50th anniversary in some ways helps to rekindle the passion that America had for this, not simply because of the science, but for what it did to not only our nation, but to the world, coming together like we did perhaps at no other time in the summer of 1969. And if we can be reminded of that, maybe that will encourage people to be more supportive of this program, which I think is produce the greatest scientific achievement in human history.
Yeah, Richard, I agree with you. I think the timing is good. You know, people are I detect anyway in my interactions with the public. And it's hard to tell here at NASA because we're all giant fans of this stuff. But when I interact with people in the public, people are sort of hungry for, okay, it's been long enough. Let's get to it. People have been inspired by, science fiction and superhero movies and whatever else that they're they're watching. And I think there's an interest in pursuing that. And you're exactly right. I mean, the impact of Apollo on our society now is hard to imagine how much different the world is. And the impact is so widespread that I don't think people sort of notice it. I mean, in terms of the boost to the economy from technology, from our complete changing of our understanding of the universe, because now, based on the samples we brought back from the moon, we found out that, in fact, the moon and Earth were formed by the proto-Earth being hit by a planet the size, basically, of Mars now, and that impact created what's now the Earth we live on and the moon that we know, and that that Genesis story for Earth kind of changes our perspective on a lot of things, and changes our understanding of the universe, and there's this whole generation of people who've like you and I, who came of age during the Apollo era, but also people who come after who've grown up with the understanding that, if we set a big goal for ourselves and apply the right resources and stay organized and focused, there's no end of what we can accomplish. I mean, how many times have you heard people say things like, if we can put a person on the moon, why can't we, fill in the blank?
Right.
That attitude, I think, has had a profound effect on not only the United States, but also our whole world.
Bill, it's great to talk with you once again. Thank you so much for making time for us this afternoon.
Rich, it's my pleasure. You know where to find me if you want to talk again.
That sounds great. We'll do it. Bill Berry, NASA's historian, as we get ready to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11.